You had the NATO base in Turkey being under attack by terrorists. A terrorist attack in Turkey. What was Manafort talking about? There had been no such incident. But when Watts, a counterintelligence expert, saw the exchange, he knew immediately what this was about. A piece of Russian disinformation that had been ricocheting around the world on social media sites for weeks. In late July, RT and Sputnik, the Russian news outlets, had reported a story about protests at the U.S. airbase in Incirlik, Turkey, where the U.S. military stored nuclear weapons, claiming that 7,000 armed police had surrounded the facility in response to a massive wave of protests by demonstrators shouting, "Death to the U.S." The base, the Russian outlet said, was in lockdown amid fears of an attack, and Sputnik reported that there was the danger that the nukes could fall into the hands of international terrorists. These stories, aimed at stoking tensions between the U.S. and Turkey, were amplified on RT and Sputnik's Twitter feeds and websites. But they had been overblown. The protests were peaceful, and U.S. officials said there was no threat to the security of the airbase. The protests had received no major U.S. media coverage. But now, a mangled version of this Russian propaganda was being repeated on national television by the campaign chairman of one of the two major party presidential candidates. What the hell? Watts thought, and later he recalled. That's when we knew something weird was going on. Watts was among a handful of private researchers who, for the past several years, had been tracking the ways that social media was being exploited by the United States' enemies. Much of his initial interest in this subject was spurred by the alarming success ISIS was having using social media to recruit thousands of young, alienated men to join the fight in Iraq and Syria. But Watts started seeing a pattern of more sophisticated messaging that seemed to be emanating from websites and Twitter accounts based in Russia. A key moment came in March 2014, when, a few weeks after Putin annexed Crimea, a strange petition popped up on the White House website. Written in clunky English by a mysterious character identified only as S.V. of Anchorage, it demanded that Alaska be returned to Russia. As kooky as the idea sounded, the petition suddenly started getting traction. Twitter accounts promoted it, messages pumping it showed up on Facebook. Within a few weeks, it had gotten nearly 40,000 signatures. For Watts, it was an eye-opener. As he examined the names on the petition, he noticed that many of them were identical with those on automated Twitter bots that had shown up in other social media campaigns pushing Kremlin propaganda. Some of these bots looked like honeypot accounts, featuring photos of attractive-looking women to lure in online audiences. He also saw that these accounts were tied to internet hecklers or trolls who fiercely attacked and ridiculed Kremlin critics and promoted Russian talking points to English-speaking audiences. The pattern that Watts discovered matched what Russian whistleblower Lyudmila Savchuk would reveal about the operations of the Internet Research Agency, the Kremlin-linked troll farm in St. Petersburg. But Watts was frustrated that the issue was not getting more attention among U.S. national security officials. He wrote a short article for a foreign policy think tank's website, noting that Facebook and Twitter were littered with pro-Russian, Western-looking accounts aimed at undermining the credibility of the U.S. government. It got little attention, but soon after it appeared, the FBI contacted him to tell him he had been targeted in a cyber attack. As a recognized expert on the manipulation of social media, Watts would occasionally be invited to give briefings at the FBI and the CIA. He began alerting his former intelligence colleagues to the ways that the Russian social media effort was increasingly targeting the United States. Russian bots had promoted the Occupy Wall Street movement and later Black Lives Matter, causes of great interest to progressives. Yet they also cheered on the far-right supporters of cattle rancher Cliven Bundy, who was locked in an armed confrontation with federal agents over grazing fees on government-owned land in southeastern Nevada. They played up a U.S. military special forces exercise in southern states called Jade Helm 15, an event that inspired a bizarre conspiracy theory that the Obama administration planned to impose martial law. All of these causes, which cut across ideological lines, were being given wide attention on RT and Sputnik, the Russian propaganda news sites. This was, Watts concluded, the return of Soviet Cold War active measures with a vengeance, the promotion of divisive and bogus news stories aimed at destabilizing Russia's adversaries using the new tools of social media. But when he gave his briefings, with charts and slides displaying the Twitter bots and RT stories, he mostly got shrugs from his former colleagues. "I don't think they understood what Russia was trying to do," he subsequently said. Others within the stovepiped U.S. intelligence community were starting to take notice, however. In 2015, the CIA had floated a proposal for a covert action program to create fake websites to counter Kremlin propaganda and to unleash the NSA to zap Russian-controlled websites and servers used to control phony Russian personas. But the plan got little support from senior Obama administration policymakers, in part because they believed at the time that the free flow of information would drown out Russian propaganda. "We believed that the truth shall set you free, that the truth would prevail," Anthony Blinken, Obama's Deputy Secretary of State, later said. That proved a bit naive. For Watts, Manafort's comments that August morning were a wake-up call. It was a sign that Russia's active measures were moving beyond the ideological fringes and now creeping into the mainstream American political dialogue. This, Watts believed, needed to be exposed, and he was determined to do so. But as he and the researchers he worked with would come to learn, there was more, much more, to the Russian effort. It was a campaign that was shrewdly exploiting America's biggest social media companies, and remarkably, almost nobody at the time realized it, not even the companies themselves. Manafort wouldn't last long. The day after the CNN interview, the New York Times reported that Ukraine's anti-corruption bureau had discovered handwritten ledgers showing Yanukovych's pro-Putin party designated $12.7 million in undisclosed cash payments for Manafort between 2007 and 2012. The newspaper noted that Ukrainian investigators had asserted these disbursements were part of an illegal, off-the-books system. Ukrainian officials were also probing a collection of offshore shell companies linked to Yanukovych's inner circle and a series of murky transactions. One of these involved the $18 million deal to sell Ukrainian cable television assets to a partnership owned by Manafort and Oleg Deripaska, the deal that had prompted the Russian oligarch to file a legal action in the Cayman Islands. Manafort's lawyer denied he had received such cash payments or been involved with any corruption in Yanukovych's regime. But it didn't matter. Trump's faith in Manafort was already eroding. He was being undermined by a new top advisor, Steve Bannon, an eccentric, rabble-rousing conservative populist. Bannon privately ridiculed the campaign chairman to Trump as an out-of-touch elitist. Bannon made fun of Manafort for wearing Oxford shirts during TV appearances from his summer home in the Hamptons. He compared him to Thurston Howell III, the millionaire castaway on Gilligan's Island. Bannon confronted Manafort over the Times story. Manafort dismissed it. Trump didn't. "I've got a crook running my campaign," he said when he read it. 4 days after the Times Ukraine story, Trump was about to go on stage at a rally in Charlotte, North Carolina, when he was handed a printout of an AP story that had just been posted. It reported the existence of emails showing that Manafort and his deputy, Rick Gates, had run a covert Washington lobbying operation on behalf of Ukraine's pro-Russia political party and noted the two operatives had not disclosed their work as foreign agents as required under federal law. Trump had finally had it. "Tell Jared to fire him," he snapped at an aide. The next morning at Trump Tower, Kushner did just that. "It will make me look guilty," Manafort protested. There was nothing he could do, Kushner told him. A press release was going out in 60 seconds. It did. Longtime Republican operative Kellyanne Conway was the new campaign manager. Bannon was the campaign's CEO. Trump's dismissal of Manafort would make little difference to the FBI. Its counterintelligence investigation into possible links between the Trump campaign and the Russians was just getting underway. On August 15th, a meeting of FBI agents working the case was held at the headquarters office of Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. One of those there was a seasoned senior agent, Peter Strzok. Strzok was the chief of the FBI's counterespionage section in the Bureau's counterintelligence division. He had been in charge of the FBI's investigation of Clinton's email server and led the questioning of the Democratic candidate in an interview a few days before Comey announced the Bureau would not recommend criminal charges. Strzok was no partisan. For the early drafts of Comey's statement, he had recommended that the director publicly describe Clinton's handling of classified information as grossly negligent, a harsh verdict that was toned down to extremely careless in Comey's final statement. But whatever he thought about Clinton's conduct, Strzok held Trump in contempt. Throughout this period, Strzok was having a relationship with an FBI lawyer named Lisa Page, and in private text messages, they described the GOP candidate to each other as an utter idiot, a menace, and a douche. In one exchange, Page texted Strzok, "God, Trump is a loathsome human." Strzok replied, "He's awful." In his texts to Page prior to this meeting, Strzok had made clear he saw the FBI's Trump-Russia probe as critical, referring to the campaign's pervasive connections with the Kremlin. But in McCabe's office, Page suggested the Bureau could take its time pursuing the probe and not risk burning sensitive sources, because Clinton was going to win the election. Strzok took a different view. What if Trump did win? What if people the FBI was now investigating were named to high-level positions? After the meeting, Strzok texted Page, "I want to believe the path you threw out for consideration in Andy's office, that there's no way he gets elected, but I'm afraid we can't take that risk. It's like an insurance policy in the unlikely event you die before you're 40. Strzok thought a Trump presidency would be a risk. The investigation was the insurance policy. 2 days after the McCabe meeting, Donald Trump trekked to an FBI field office in New York City, which had a secure conference room. He brought with him Michael Flynn and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, a former rival for the nomination who had become one of Trump's most prominent supporters. Trump was there to receive his first official intelligence briefing. These classified sessions were routinely conducted for major presidential nominees. They tended not to offer the candidates information that was highly sensitive. The aim was to provide them updates that went a bit beyond what they could read in newspapers. And Trump, with his comments about Putin, his and his associates' ties with Russia, and his penchant for speaking recklessly, had caused concern within the U.S. intelligence community about whether he could be trusted with sensitive information. His briefing would certainly not be loaded with information the IC did not want leaked or shared. The feeling was mutual, and Trump had done little to create a positive atmosphere for the sessions. Hours before the meeting, an interview with Trump aired in which he said he did not have much trust in current U.S. intelligence officials. Yet now, he was sitting in a room with briefers sent by the intelligence community. Trump, notorious for being impatient with briefings, was presented basic material on security threats and challenges around the world. But during the meeting, Trump was given information that directly affected him. It contradicted what he and his campaign had been saying for weeks. He was told, as Clapper would later confirm, there were direct links between Putin's regime and the hacks and information dumps that had targeted the Democrats and the Clinton campaign. Clinton, too, received a similar briefing around this time. Now Trump and Flynn knew that the U.S. intelligence community was convinced the DNC penetration and the Guccifer 2.0 and WikiLeaks releases were part of a Russian operation, and that this was not, as the Trump campaign had originally claimed, a hoax. Yet this briefing would not stop Trump and his campaign from dismissing assertions of Russian intervention. He didn't trust his briefers. It was the start of what would become a feud between Trump and the U.S. intelligence community that would last throughout the campaign and beyond. A few days earlier, another Russian strike occurred, showing how pervasive Putin's cyber attacks had been. The target was the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, DCCC, and the impact of this latest dumping operation, which would include the organization's most important internal memos, would be as disruptive and consequential as anything that had happened so far. Kelly Ward was the DCCC's executive director. It was her job to get Democrats elected to the House. Even though the DCCC shared the same Capitol Hill office building as the DNC, it was a separate entity from the DNC, and the party brass had not told her that the DCCC, too, had been penetrated by Russian hackers until minutes before the Washington Post broke the news of the DNC hack. It was only then that Amy Dacey, the DNC's chief executive officer, called to give Ward a heads up. Ward was at first shocked. Later, she pressed for an explanation. Why hadn't Dacey told her earlier? After all, the DNC had known for weeks the Russians had compromised its computers and those of the DCCC. Dacey said that the DNC couldn't alert the DCCC because CrowdStrike was trying to kick the Russians out without the hackers discovering they had been caught and couldn't risk any leaks. Now, weeks later, Ward was furious. Democrats didn't trust fellow Democrats? After learning of the breach, Ward had hired CrowdStrike as well and soon got back a damage assessment. Fancy Bear had wormed its way into 23 separate DCCC computers in 7 different departments. It had gained access to the committee's main server, hosting 2.5 million documents. Fortunately for the DCCC, it kept its email on the cloud. Haley Dierker, Ward's chief of staff, began working with the FBI's Adrian Hawkins, the same agent who nearly a year earlier had tried to alert the DNC to the Russian hack. She soon learned something astonishing. The Russians had been using servers at businesses in Virginia and Chicago as pass-throughs for the material they were exfiltrating from the DCCC's computers. She would later be told that the businesses weren't co-conspirators. These firms had no idea that the Russians had covertly commandeered their networks to swipe DCCC documents. On August 12th, Ward and Dierker were meeting at FBI headquarters with Jim Traynor, the cyber chief at the FBI, for an afternoon briefing on the Russian attack. The day before, Traynor had briefed Donna Brazile, the interim DNC chair, and other party officials on the DNC attack. Michael Sussman and Sean Henry of CrowdStrike were also there. The two women did not find the session useful. It felt as if they were being read the Wikipedia page for Fancy Bear. They had gotten no answers to what worried them the most. Which documents did the Russians steal? Afterward, the two women were having a drink at Asia 9, a trendy restaurant near the Hoover Building, when Dierker got an alert. Guccifer 2.0 had struck again. "It's time for new revelations now," he proclaimed on his website. Some hacked DCCC documents had appeared in earlier dumps, but they hadn't made much of a splash. But now, the suspected Russian intelligence front posted a cache of DCCC records that included login details for DCCC accounts and a strategy memo for a key congressional race in Florida. But the most immediate problem was that Guccifer 2.0 also released a document listing the phone numbers, email addresses, and home addresses of all Democratic members of the House. The DCCC quickly set up a war room to deal with this assault. Congress was on recess, most of the members were back in their districts, and now each were vulnerable to protesters, or kooks who could show up at their residences. The Capitol Police dispatched state troopers to many of their homes. Two of them were vandalized. Some representatives immediately began to get abusive and angry calls, texts, and emails. Representative Emmanuel Cleaver from Missouri received what he called an avalanche of mean-spirited phone calls that came from people using profanity and the N-word, while obscene and racist emails poured into his inbox. Pelosi the next day sent a letter to all Democratic House members to inform them of this electronic Watergate break-in. She advised her colleagues to not let family members read incoming texts or answer their phones. Pelosi herself had been victimized. "I have received scores of mostly obscene and sick calls, voicemails, and text messages," she wrote. Pelosi held an emergency conference call for all members of the Democratic caucus. It was a dispiriting session. Panicky members peppered Pelosi with questions about whether they had to change their cell phone numbers and personal emails. It was every man and woman for themselves. All of this frustrated Michael Sussman, the Democratic lawyer who participated in the call. "They weren't discussing the greater threat," he said. "They weren't talking about what to do about the Russians." Guccifer 2.0's dump with the personal data of Democrats was just the beginning. In the following weeks, Guccifer 2.0 orchestrated a series of releases containing some of the DCCC's most sensitive strategy files, field plans, finance documents, and crucial voter data, including the turnout models the DCCC had developed in different districts. The internet persona gave exclusives to political bloggers in some of the districts and select media outlets, including The Hill, The Daily Caller, and The Observer, which was owned by Jared Kushner. The leaked material included internal memos about crucial swing district races in Florida, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, New Hampshire, and elsewhere. Perhaps the most damaging documents were candid assessments of Democratic candidates, covering their strengths and weaknesses. In one South Florida race, Guccifer 2.0 released blunt DCCC memos about a primary battle in which one candidate, Annette Tadeo, the contender the DCCC favored, was described as a somewhat poor fundraiser with a reputation as an inadequate campaigner. Her Democratic rival, Joe Garcia, whom the DCCC believed to be the weaker candidate for the general election, was a flashback to a corrupt line of politicians who, embarrassingly, had been caught on a C-SPAN video picking his earwax and seemingly eating it. The DCCC releases did not cause as much of a national political fuss as the DNC emails posted prior to the Democratic convention. But they had a direct impact and may well have succeeded in influencing elections. In the Florida race, Garcia would make use of the dumped material and defeat Tadeo, only to later lose to his Republican rival. Whether by design or by accident, Guccifer 2.0 had revealed material related to some of the most competitive congressional races of 2016. "We felt what they were doing was strategic and targeted," Ward recalled. "The memos they were dumping were about our most important districts." Ward, Dierker, and other DCCC staffers knew they were being attacked by Russia and felt they were utterly on their own. Obama wasn't saying anything. The media was barely covering this. Ward and Dierker tried to get their counterparts at the National Republican Congressional Committee to denounce the Russian attack and eschew using the material Moscow had stolen. But there was no interest from the GOP. Instead, the National Republican Congressional Committee would use some of the hacked documents as fodder for TV ads. One GOP-leaning Florida blogger, who eagerly solicited Guccifer 2.0 and posted files from the hacker, profusely thanked him for the material. "I don't think you realize what you gave me," wrote the anonymous blogger known as Hello FLA exclamation point. "This is probably worth $1 million. Okay. You owe me $1 million. Guccifer 2.0 responded. Manafort, long an obsession for Democratic opposition researchers on the Russian trail, was out of the picture. But now the Democrats were focusing on another Trump ally, Roger Stone. The 64-year-old Stone was a self-professed practitioner of the dark arts of politics. A one-time Nixon aide, his back bore a tattoo of the 37th president, Stone prided himself on being an all-out political warrior, willing to sling mud or worse at his foes. Stone told reporters his motto was, "Admit nothing, deny everything, launch counterattack." And he did it with relish, trafficking in conspiracy theories. In 2013, he published a book alleging that Lyndon Johnson had killed John F. Kennedy. As the 2016 campaign got underway, he published another book, The Clintons' War on Women, a savage attack on Hillary Clinton for allegedly targeting women who had exposed her husband's conduct. It carried an approving blurb from Trump. "This book on Hillary, really tough. We appreciate Roger Stone. He is one tough cookie." Stone had been a friend of Trump's for more than 30 years, dating back to the days they both were pals of Roy Cohn, the New York mob lawyer and political fixer who had once been Joe McCarthy's chief counsel. Stone had also been Trump's on-again, off-again political advisor. He had been one of the first hires for the presidential campaign, working with Trump through the first half of 2015 to develop his Make America Great Again strategy. But in August of that year, Trump fired Stone, though Stone insisted he had quit, frustrated with Trump's tendency to diverge from the main anti-establishment message of his campaign and become embroiled in controversies involving personalities and provocative media fights. Still, Stone remained one of Trump's most ardent champions. "I'm the ultimate Trump loyalist," he declared. At the Republican convention, he and Alex Jones, the notorious InfoWars conspiracy theorist, headlined a rally of Trump supporters. In front of the modest-sized crowd, Stone called Hillary Clinton a short-tempered, foul-mouthed, bipolar, mentally unbalanced criminal. It was typical Stone excess. And Stone seemed still to be plugged into the Trump camp. At the GOP convention, he told one journalist that in between appearing at events where he called for Clinton to be locked up, he had been meeting with Trump campaign staff and discussing strategy. So Clinton campaign officials kept a close eye on Stone. If the Trump camp was engaged in anything underhanded, they assumed Stone would be part of the scheme. And in early August, they picked up a troubling clue that suggested to them he might be in league with WikiLeaks in relation to the Russia operation. On August 8th, Stone gave a speech to a Florida Republican group in which he claimed that Clinton's emails would emerge and show stone-cold proof of the criminality of Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton. When an attendee asked him what Assange was going to do for an October surprise to affect the election, Stone replied, "Well, it could be any number of things. I actually have communicated with Assange. I believe the next tranche of his documents pertain to the Clinton Foundation, but there's no telling what the October surprise may be." Glenn Kaplan, the Russia Oppo man at Clinton headquarters, and some of his colleagues were astonished by Stone's remarks. They saw this as an admission from a longtime associate of Trump that he was in contact with a key player in the Russian attack on their campaign. Shortly after WikiLeaks had put out the DNC emails prior to the Democratic Convention, Assange had told CNN that his website expected to release a lot more material related to the election. And now, a Trump confidant was publicly saying he was in touch with Assange. The fact that Roger Stone, who was infamous for dirty tricks, had said this was alarming, Kaplan later remarked. Stone had jumped headfirst into the Russia controversy. A few days before his talk in Florida, he had penned a piece for Steve Bannon's Breitbart, in which he claimed Guccifer 2.0 was indeed a lone hacker and responsible for the DNC breach, not the Russians. After Twitter suspended Guccifer 2.0's account for posting the personal information of House Democrats, Stone defended the internet persona, calling the move outrageous and asking, "Why are those exposing the truth banned?" He hailed Guccifer 2.0 as a hero. When the account was restored a few days later, Stone exclaimed in a tweet, "Thank you, sweet Jesus, I've prayed for it." Guccifer 2.0 was grateful. In one tweet, the hacker, or hackers, addressed Stone and said, "Thanks that you believe in the real hashtag Guccifer 2. And after Stone posted a link to a story he had written claiming the election could be rigged against Trump, the Guccifer 2.0 Twitter account promoted it and said to Stone, "Paying you back." Stone and Guccifer 2.0 even traded private messages on Twitter. In one, Stone asked Guccifer 2.0 to promote a story he had written. And in a private tweet to Stone, Guccifer 2.0 said, "I'm pleased to say that you are a great man. Please tell me if I can help you anyhow. It would be a great pleasure to me." Stone also championed WikiLeaks and Assange, suggesting he knew what WikiLeaks would next be throwing at Clinton. In an interview with Jerome Corsi, a writer for WorldNet Daily, a right-wing site, Stone boasted that he had directly interacted with Assange and had learned that the WikiLeaks founder possessed a set of the 30,000 personal emails Clinton had destroyed. Assange, Stone said, claims the emails contain enough damaging information to put Hillary Clinton in jail for selling State Department official acts in exchange for contributions to the Clinton Foundation. This was amazing news, or would be, if true. Assange possessed Clinton's personal emails. Had Assange really told Stone this, or was Stone seeking to stir the pot and make trouble however he could? In between posting tweets in which he claimed that Clinton's health was precarious and alleged the vote counting machines were going to be rigged against Trump, Stone kept asserting that Assange had Clinton's emails, that they contained proof of criminal activity, and that America will have them soon. In an interview with conservative commentator Dana Loesch, Stone said, "I believe Mr. Assange has all of the emails that Huma Abedin and Cheryl Mills, the two top Clinton aides, believed they had destroyed. So, Assange is going to be very influential in this election." At the time, it looked to the Clinton staffers, and many others, that Stone might well have an inside track with WikiLeaks, and by extension, the Russians. They were worried more hacked materials, including John Podesta's emails, might yet be coming out. And when Stone tweeted on August 21st, "Trust me, it will soon be Podesta's time in the barrel," they took notice. Stone's tweet made them wonder if their worst fears might soon come true. Stone later claimed that he never had communicated directly with Assange, and there was no public evidence to the contrary. Everything he knew about WikiLeaks' plans, he insisted, he had gleaned from Assange's own tweets, which he then confirmed in multiple conversations with his back channel to Assange, Randy Credico, a New York radio show host and comic who was an Assange champion. There was, however, a problem with Stone's story. According to Credico, he had never spoken to Assange until the WikiLeaks founder was a guest on his show on August 25th, 17 days after Stone first claimed to have communicated with Assange. Credico, a left-wing activist and Bernie Sanders supporter, had an unlikely friendship with Stone, but he said he absolutely never told Stone anything about Assange's plans to release emails damaging to Clinton, because he never knew anything about them. "He's got me as the fall guy," Credico said. "It's ridiculous." Chapter 16. Does it even matter who hacked this data? No one else was in the room where it happened, just Obama and Putin and their translators. In early September, during the G20 summit in Hangzhou, Obama and Putin had what diplomats called a sidelines meeting. For this session, no aides were present. It was as private a conversation as possible between the leaders of nuclear superpowers. It went on for an hour and a half. Afterward, the two men left the conference room, each looking somber and grim-faced. They made no statements to reporters. There was no joint press conference. A senior White House official told reporters the talks were candid and blunt. He said they were primarily devoted to ending the war in Syria, the still simmering conflict in Ukraine, and in a vague reference, Russia's cyber intrusions. The president informed his aides he had delivered the message he and his advisors had crafted. "We know what you're doing. If you don't cut it out, we will impose onerous and unprecedented penalties." One senior U.S. government official briefed on the meeting was told the president said to Putin, in effect, "You fuck with us over the election, and we'll crash your economy." Putin had denied everything to Obama, and as he had done before, blamed the United States for interfering in Russian politics. His response was hardly a surprise. 3 days earlier, in an interview with Bloomberg in Moscow, Putin had dismissed the cyber attack on the DNC. "I don't know anything about it, and on a state level, Russia has never done this," he said. Then he echoed the arguments of Julian Assange. "Does it even matter who hacked this data? The important thing is the content that was given to the public." Putin, never known for his commitment to transparency in Russia, was now the advocate for the American public's right to know. If Obama was tough in private, publicly, he played the statesman. Asked at a post-summit news conference about Russia's hacking of the election, the president spoke in generalities and insisted the United States did not want a blow-up over the issue. "We've had problems with cyber intrusions from Russia in the past, from other countries in the past," he said. "Our goal is not to suddenly, in the cyber arena, duplicate a cycle of escalation that we saw when it comes to other arms races in the past, but rather to start instituting some norms so that everybody's acting responsibly." John Podesta, Clinton's campaign chairman, listened intently to Obama's post-G20 press conference and was disappointed. He wanted more out of Obama, not this tepid response, especially on a day when the Washington Post was reporting that U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies were investigating what they see as a broad, covert Russian operation in the United States to sow public distrust in the upcoming presidential election and in U.S. political institutions. For weeks, the Clinton campaign had been trying to promote the case that it was under assault from a Russian government that had close ties to their Republican rival. But as Podesta and other campaign officials saw it, Obama's comments hardly spoke to the gravity of the matter. If the president would not publicly acknowledge the Russian role, it placed them at a serious disadvantage. If Barack Obama had gone out and said the U.S. was under attack and were going to take action, a top Clinton advisor later said, it would have had a major impact on how the story was covered. It would have made people sit up and take notice and remove this impediment. After all, if this was a big deal, wouldn't our government be doing something? There was one senior U.S. government official willing to speak out about the Russian hack, and it was the last person the Clinton campaign would have expected to come to its rescue, James Comey. The FBI director had decided he would draft an op-ed to run in either the New York Times or the Washington Post that spelled out Russia's meddling and explained that this was a new national security threat that the government and the public needed to take seriously. Comey wrote a draft of the article and told officials at the White House he planned to submit it to run the Sunday after the G20 summit. Then some White House aides identified a problem. That Sunday was September 11th. Maybe this wasn't the best day for the FBI director to be talking about anything other than the memory of the nearly 3,000 Americans killed in the terror attack. Comey pulled back his plans to submit the piece for that weekend. Afterward, White House officials nixed the idea entirely. If the government was going to speak out on this issue, it would do so with one voice through the intelligence community. The piece never ran. Trump was still dismissing the notion of any Russian involvement. He gave an interview that week to veteran broadcaster Larry King. "I think maybe the Democrats are putting that out," he said, when asked about claims of Russian hacking of the election. "Who knows, but I think it's pretty unlikely." Trump campaign aides would later say the candidate thought the interview would run on King's podcast. In fact, it ran on King's new TV outlet, RT, the Russian propaganda station. Days after Obama was back from China, he called the four congressional leaders, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, Harry Reid, and Nancy Pelosi, to the Oval Office. The White House had been trying for the past couple of weeks to hold such a session, but McConnell and Ryan had claimed scheduling conflicts. Obama's aides wondered if the Republicans were ducking the president. The official White House schedule noted that the purpose of this meeting was for the president to update the lawmakers on the G20 summit, but the real agenda was the Russian operation. All four had been briefed by Brennan and told the available intelligence indicated that the Russians had launched the operation to derail the U.S. election, harm Clinton, and possibly help Trump, and that it was likely this was a plot approved, if not directed, by Putin. Now, in this meeting, where none of the legislators were allowed to bring aides, Obama explained that he wanted them to come together, put party aside, and as the top leaders of the United States, issue a joint public statement declaring there was a potential threat to the election and urging state and local officials to work with the federal government to thwart any attempt to tarnish the election. Obama also hoped that the statement would identify Russia as the source of the threat. But the plea was doomed by the poisonous political atmosphere in Washington. The main obstacle was McConnell. Obama and his top aides viewed the Senate Majority Leader as an unrelenting partisan who had blocked the president's initiatives for years and, most recently, wouldn't even allow the Senate to vote on Obama's Supreme Court pick. And McConnell didn't trust Obama and suspected that he and his senior aides were hyping the intelligence to help Clinton. In the Oval Office meeting, he told the president he thought he was trying to politicize the matter. He wouldn't help him do so by signing off on any bipartisan message. To our dismay and disbelief, McConnell said this was BS. "You're just trying to help Hillary Clinton," one senior administration aide later said. Ryan wasn't quite as adamant. Still, it was election season. McConnell realized that if he accepted Obama's request, he would essentially be undercutting his own party's nominee. Any damage to Trump's campaign would also hurt Republican candidates running for the Senate and threaten McConnell's position as majority leader. Trump's refusal to acknowledge the Russian hacking was preventing McConnell from cooperating with Obama. In the days after the meeting, Jay Johnson and Lisa Monaco briefed other members of Congress, and McDonough and Monaco attempted to persuade McConnell to change his mind. Ryan, too, tried. He told White House aides that they should let him work on McConnell, saying that maybe he could bring the majority leader around. Ryan had long functioned as an intermediary between the White House and McConnell. But McConnell held firm. By now, the White House was caught in a squeeze. Top Democrats on the intelligence committees were restless. It had been 2 months since the intelligence community had reached the conclusion that Russia was threatening the election and was behind the WikiLeaks dump at the Democratic convention. Yet the White House had said nothing about it. Senator Dianne Feinstein, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and Representative Adam Schiff, her counterpart on the House Intelligence Panel, had both been briefed by Brennan and were alarmed. They began pressing the White House to speak out and tell the public what was going on. Feinstein was being egged on by Hillary Clinton, who would occasionally stay at her house in California. Schiff viewed the matter in a larger context. He had been concerned for some time about the administration's failure to publicly attribute cyber hacks to their state sponsors, arguing that this made such attacks a penalty-free enterprise. He wanted more than just a public statement. He wanted the White House to start talking to European allies about sanctions. In Feinstein and Schiff's view, this was not something that should wait until after the election. The pair spoke with other Democrats on the Hill, who agreed. The American public had to be told. If the White House would not say anything, Feinstein and Schiff were prepared to issue their own statement holding the Russians accountable. White House officials were not happy. They were still hoping they could win over McConnell. If two top congressional Democrats spoke out on the issue, it would only reinforce McConnell's view that the whole thing was partisan. Chief of Staff McDonough was assigned the task of keeping Feinstein and Schiff bottled up. McDonough pleaded with the two Democrats to hold off. He conveyed to the two Democrats the White House belief that a partisan statement attributing the hacks and dumps to the Russians would play into Trump's narrative that the election was rigged and spread uncertainty about the election. He raised other objections. A public statement by them would impede the effort to work with the state and local election officials, especially in red states where suspicions about the administration ran high. He urged Feinstein and Schiff to wait, while the White House kept pressuring McConnell and Ryan to sign on to the letter they wanted to send to the state officials. This whole episode, aides later said, irritated Obama. Schiff and Feinstein at first agreed to hold back for a few days, but they soon tired of waiting, and on September 22nd, released a brief but powerful four-paragraph statement. "Based on briefings we have received," it said, "we have concluded that the Russian intelligence agencies are making a serious and concerted effort to influence the U.S. election." The pair reported that the effort was intended to sow doubt about the security of our election and may well be intended to influence the outcomes of the election. And they added, "We believe that orders for the Russian intelligence agencies to conduct such actions could come only from very senior levels of the Russian government. They called on Putin to immediately halt the operation." Before issuing the statement, Feinstein and Schiff vetted it with the intelligence community. They wanted to be sure they would not inadvertently disclose any secret sources and methods. The IC had no objection. Schiff considered this a bizarre situation. The White House was not willing to publicly identify Russia as the culprit, but the intelligence community was allowing two Democratic members of Congress to cite intelligence briefings to do so, and to basically declare Putin was running this operation. The Feinstein-Schiff statement, with its reference to the briefings they had received, was a clear public signal that U.S. intelligence agencies had concluded Russian intelligence, on Putin's orders, was attempting to subvert an American presidential election. Reporting on the statement, the Washington Post noted, "The blunt language goes far beyond the more equivocal characterizations issued by the White House and U.S. intelligence agencies, which have so far been unwilling to explicitly blame Moscow." Even so, Feinstein and Schiff's effort made barely a ripple. It had been released by two Democratic partisans and did not have the official imprimatur of the U.S. intelligence community. Their letter received relatively little attention. Stories about it ran inside the major newspapers, and it went unmentioned on the network news. Unable to yet coax a statement out of McConnell, the Obama administration now redoubled its efforts to reach out to local election officials. The idea of vote tampering was still the number one concern. In mid-September, Johnson issued his own statement noting DHS had seen efforts at cyber intrusions of voter registration data maintained in state election systems. He noted the DHS was ready to assist state and local election officials in protecting their systems. Johnson added, "We strongly encourage more state and local election officials to do so." This was not a message to convince or scare anyone into fully cooperating with the federal government, nor did it convey the apprehension at the top levels of the U.S. government about the nearing election. But it was the best the administration could manage while waiting for McConnell. That wait did not pay off. A week after Feinstein and Schiff sounded the alarm, the four leaders of Congress, including McConnell, finally issued a letter. It was not the clear warning the White House had envisioned. The letter was brief. It declared that states face the challenge of malefactors that are seeking to use cyber attacks to disrupt the administration of our elections. There was no mention of Russia. It urged states to take full advantage of the robust public and private resources available to them to ensure that their network infrastructure is secure from attack. The missive held little sense of urgency. It was not much more than an iteration of the obvious and bland encouragement for states to consider seeking help from DHS. Like the Feinstein-Schiff letter, it made no difference. In September, Matt Tate, the British cybersecurity expert who had helped expose Guccifer 2.0 as a Russian front, received an odd call from Peter W. Smith, a Chicago-based private equity executive and veteran Republican activist. A longtime nemesis of the Clintons, Smith in the 1990s helped fund the research for Troopergate, the story that quoted Arkansas state troopers saying they arranged sexual liaisons for Bill Clinton when he was Arkansas governor. Smith was on a quest for the Holy Grail, Hillary Clinton's deleted emails. He told Tate that he had been contacted by someone on the dark web, a corner of the internet that is invisible to search engines and allows for anonymous communications, often for illegal transactions. This contact claimed to possess the private emails Clinton had deleted from her server. Smith asked if Tate could help him determine if the emails were authentic. Tate assumed Smith had reached out to him because he had been going through the thousands of Clinton's State Department emails that were being released in batches by the department each month and tweeting out interesting nuggets. Tate hadn't been looking to score partisan points. He was mostly interested in the emails for insights into Clinton's thinking about national security and cyber issues. But he soon grew a bit suspicious of Smith, and even more about his supposed dark web contact. Smith was cagey in talking about whoever this dark web source was. He never identified the person or explained how they connected. After a few conversations, Tate warned Smith that his mysterious source might be part of a Russian clandestine influence campaign to entice Smith and end up supplying him with doctored emails. But Smith was undeterred. Even more concerning for Tate, Smith gave the impression he was somehow involved with the Trump campaign, that he was in touch with Michael Flynn, Flynn's son, and other top campaign aides. He talked like a Trump insider, sharing tales from the campaign. He even was planning to set up an off-the-books Oppo research operation for Trump. He sent a memo to Tate, presumably by mistake, that described a company Smith had set up as a Delaware LLC called KLS Research to conduct opposition research for the Trump campaign, but in a way to avoid campaign reporting. The memo noted that several senior Trump campaign aides were involved in the project, including Steve Bannon, Kellyanne Conway, Michael Flynn, Sam Clovis, and Lisa Nelson. Tate's name was also listed. Whether Smith ever had any contact with Trump insiders was never clear to Tate. Bannon and Conway would both later say they didn't know who he was. But Smith plowed ahead on his quest for the Clinton emails, enlisting other technology experts, including a Russian-speaking investigator in Europe. After the election, Smith would tell the Wall Street Journal that he had found five groups of hackers that claimed to have the Clinton emails, including two that were Russian. He said he had obtained batches of these emails, but he could not determine if they were genuine. He suggested to the hackers they should take them to WikiLeaks. The whole episode was murky, save for one piece of intriguing intelligence that the journal came across in reporting its story. U.S. intelligence agencies had collected information indicating that Russian hackers were indeed discussing how to find Clinton's emails and how to get them to Flynn through a cutout. Whether Smith was the cutout was never determined. In May 2017, about 10 days after he discussed his campaign project with the Journal, the 81-year-old Smith committed suicide by asphyxiating himself in a hotel room in Rochester, Minnesota. According to local authorities, he left a note that said, "No foul play whatsoever." Chapter 17. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed who weighs 400 pounds, okay? By mid-September, Glenn Simpson was getting frustrated. The memos from Christopher Steele were still coming in with more wild and fascinating but unconfirmed tidbits from his Russian emigre collector. The new reports, if anything, were more incriminating than the first ones. In his initial June report, Steele had written that the Kremlin had been cultivating Trump for at least 5 years. A report Steele sent to Simpson on July 30th went further. It quoted a source claiming there had been a regular exchange of information between Trump and the Kremlin for at least 8 years. Putin was supposedly relying on Trump and his associates for intelligence on the activities of Russian oligarchs inside the United States, a subject of great interest to the Russian president. In exchange for the high levels of voluntary cooperation, the Russians had promised not to use their kompromat on Trump. And kompromat there was. Plenty of it, according to Steele. It wasn't only the golden shower incident in the Moscow hotel room. A Steele report dated September 14th cited two knowledgeable St. Petersburg sources claiming that Trump had paid bribes during visits to that city to try to get business deals and participated in sex parties. Aras Agalarov, Trump's business partner in the Miss Universe pageant, supposedly knew all about these escapades, but all direct witnesses had been silenced, bribed, or coerced to disappear. Simpson would read these reports and throw up his hands. The main purpose of opposition research was to develop information about the rival candidate that could be of some utility to the client, as material for television attack ads or talking points during a debate. What was he supposed to do with this stuff? What could the Clinton campaign possibly do with it? There was no way to verify most of it. Chris's stuff was almost unusable, Simpson recalled. Even Steele's partner, Chris Burrows, had his doubts about the veracity of some of this material. But one factor mitigated any concerns. Everyone assumed Clinton was going to beat Trump. "We were fairly relaxed about producing stuff about a candidate that is not going to win," Burroughs subsequently remarked. And yet, for all the sensational and uncorroborated claims, Steele had clearly stumbled upon a larger truth. There was, indeed, an ambitious campaign by the Kremlin to influence the American electorate. The DNC hack and the dumping of emails by WikiLeaks had proven that. It was a campaign that, according to Steele's reporting, had produced turmoil within the Kremlin. Peskov, Putin's trusted spokesman who was allegedly overseeing the campaign, was supposedly scared shitless that he would be scapegoated if there were a backlash against Russia's interference in the election. A Russian diplomat in Washington, who was said to have been involved in the operation, had been withdrawn for fear his role might be exposed. It would later turn out that a Kremlin diplomat with a similar name was in fact sent back to Moscow around this time.